What did you plan for me? Are you an assassin?
The Sisterhood, she said.
He couldn't look at her bruised lips and smashed teeth. All the blood made him uncomfortable.
Breeding records. You must not have children. Tainted bloodline. They sent me to sterilize you.
Salvador fumed. Sterilize me? They want to destroy the Carino line?
No, just yours. Roderick's line should be the Carino Emperor's.
His brother's brow furrowed in deep concern. The Sisterhood is scheming against the Imperial Throne. He shot a glance at Salvador. We need to get Anna away from them. We sent her there to keep her safe. But Joma wasn't finished. What started out as a laugh turned into a cough. She seemed to feel a surge of defiant energy, and she spoke with absolute clarity.
After seeing how the Butlerians have you under their thumb, I decided sterilizing you wasn't good enough. You should be killed instead.
She slumped back onto the table.
You're going to execute me anyway, so I'll tell you what everyone is saying behind your back. Roderick would be the better leader by far.
When the two men returned to the palace after changing clothes to remove the sweat and bloodstains, they were surprised to encounter a somber, formal delegation from Rossack, Sister Dorothea, two other sisters, and Anna.
Well,
Salvador said, looking at his brother as they both stepped up onto the throne dais in the meeting hall. I suppose that's fortunate timing, now that we know what they're really up to. Roderick, though, narrowed his eyes and regarded the delegation with concern. Anna looked confused and disoriented, physically unharmed, but wrong, somehow, and very much changed. Holding the young woman's hand, Dorothea stepped forward and bowed. Her voice was soft and contrite. Your Highness, a terrible tragedy has occurred. Roderick came forward quickly to grasp his sister's arms, checking her to see what was wrong, but Anna didn't even look at him. Her eyes flicked back and forth, her gaze dancing to an unheard beat. Salvador remained focused on Sister Dorothea.
Explain yourself, and understand that your life and the fate of the entire Rossack school will depend on your answer.
My answer is the truth, and will not change, threat or no threat.
She did not remove her gaze from Salvador's.
Long ago, our Reverend Mother Raquella survived an assassin's poison by altering the biochemistry of her body. This transformation gave her access to intense control over every aspect of her body and unlocked a host of memories from past generations. She became our first Reverend Mother.
Salvador was already growing impatient.
I want to know what you've done to my sister, not a history lesson on your order.
Dorothea did not hurry her explanation.
For many years, the Sisterhood has been trying to recreate that transformation, exposing volunteers to dangerous chemicals in hopes of finding the key. Virtually all the volunteers died in the attempt, but I recently became the first new Reverend Mother. Once the technique was proved, other sisters also made the attempt, so that we now have more Reverend Mothers.
Abruptly, Anna began rattling off words at a rapid clip. Salvador realized they were all the names of planets in the Imperium.
Anna convinced herself that she was ready, though none of us believed so. She was impulsive, stole a dose of the drug, and consumed it before anyone could stop her. She lay in a coma for many days, but did not die. When she awakened, she was altered, as you see.
Dorothea's voice remained remarkably steady.
But I don't think she's a Reverend Mother. She seems to be somewhere in between.
Upset, Roderick demanded, and with so many deaths from this drug, why wasn't it guarded well enough to keep our sister away from it? You knew her emotional problems. That was why we sent her to the Sisterhood, for you to keep her safe.
Anna is extremely willful, Dorothea said, and smart.
No, I'm smarter,
Anna interrupted in a slurred voice.
There are people in my head, special instructors. Hear them.
She spewed out a jumble of sentences, words, and unintelligible sounds that made no sense, as if they poured out of a bowl in which they had been mixed. Her blue eyes were like glassy marbles, her expression vacant. Dorothea looked worried. In the process of becoming a reverend mother, a sister taps into a vast reservoir of female lives, a host of memories. Anna seems to have partially succeeded.
Abruptly, the young woman stopped her flow of disconnected words and said in her own familiar tone,
"The voices are telling me to go away now. They don't like me intruding on them, but it is too late. I'm already there."
"Anna," Roderick said, "would you like to sit and talk with me now, the way we used to? You're home now, where it's safe."
She didn't respond, gave no indication that she had heard him. Her eyes seemed to peer into a hidden inner world. One of the main doors swung open, and Lady Orenna came into the entrance hall, wearing a white and gold robe.
"I just heard Anna's come back to us."
She hurried to the stricken princess.
"Oh, child, how are you?"
Anna seemed to hear her stepmother. Her face was a mask of sadness as she looked at the older woman.
"They hurt me."
"Who hurt you?"
Salvador asked, rising from his throne.
"The voices. They hurt me every time they talk. Little needles of pain inside my brain."
The Virgin Empress put her arm around Anna and drew her close.
"Why don't you stay in my quarters tonight, dear? I'll take care of you. And tomorrow we'll go inside that fogwood shrub you like so much." "I'd like that,"
Anna said.
"I'm home now."
Emperor Salvador leveled a malevolent gaze at Dorothea and her two companions.
"This is the second time the Sisterhood has failed me. In one day, I will shut down and scatter your entire school."
Roderick touched his older brother's arm discreetly. "But there's more we need to know. Perhaps we should have further discussions about the proper response to this problem. A rash action now could have repercussions across the Imperium."
Sister Dorothea astonished them by speaking up.
"Emperor Salvador, I understand your anger. Much of the Sisterhood is corrupt and should be eliminated, but we can save the rest. Some, such as myself and my Reverend Mother companions, believe in a different sort of Sisterhood, one that furthers the noble purposes of the Imperium. It is time to remove the excesses, cauterize the wounds, and move forward along the appropriate path."
Salvador made a rude snort. "I know all about your Sisterhood's schemes, your breeding records, your plot to prevent me from having offspring. Fortunately, we caught your puppet, Dr. Joma, before she could sterilize me."
Dorothea's expression became puzzled.
"I was not aware of that plan.
But Dr. Joma was a protege of the Reverend Mother's. I do not know her well. However, I agree wholeheartedly, sire. The Sisterhood's breeding program is at the heart of their corruption. There are dark secrets among the Sisters of Rossak. But I implore you to keep in mind that some of us are reasonable and wish to work with you, for you, sire. Some of us are loyal to the Imperium and to the cautious philosophy of the Butlerians."
"How many are in your faction?" Roderick asked.
"We are a minority, but many of the new Reverend Mothers share my deep concerns."
"Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind,"
said one of Dorothea's companions, a diminutive woman with a rounded nose and a mole on her left cheek. Salvador felt decidedly uncomfortable.
"Yes, I have heard Manfred Tarondo quote that many times. What does she mean here? What does that have to do with what happened to Anna?"
The thought of Shoma's conspiracy was fresh in his mind.
"Sister Gessie speaks of the most terrible thing the Sisterhood has done," Dorothea said.
in their restricted caves. They use forbidden computers to maintain their breeding records. Even I am not allowed access to that part of our school, but I have seen the computers in my other memories.
Roderick stiffened.
Thinking machines, hidden inside the caves of Rossack?
What?
Salvador's shout echoed in the vaulted entrance chamber.
There is a rot at the core of the Sisterhood, but some of us do not find it acceptable. That is why I wanted to bring Anna back personally. I needed to speak with you, sire, to inform you of this travesty. There needs to be a purging of the order, not a destruction. I would urge a course correction. I beg you not to punish our whole order for the actions of a corrupt few. Most of the sisters do not know of this terrible crime, and they would join us if given the opportunity.
And the illegal computers, Roderick said. You have proof. You can find them.
I am certain of it. We can enlist the aid of Manfred Tarondo.
With an alarmed look, Salvador said, No need to involve the Butlerians. The Imperium is my responsibility. I'll send a military squad to take care of this.
He looked over at his brother, feeling pleased for the first time all day.
There. It's decided.
The Mistborn have been cast out by the sorceresses, but those who survived know the underbelly of the jungle better than anyone else. Because of my past history with them, secret places have been revealed to us.
Reverend Mother Rakella, pre-dawn address to the faithful. The Sisterhood had to be prepared. Not only did the rush of inner voices warn Rakella of the impending crisis, but Sister Valya had told her a specific reason for the threat. In becoming a Reverend Mother, Dorothea had learned, through Rakella's old embedded memories, about the secret computers. And she intended to expose the illegal technology to the Butlerians. Rakella had to do something to protect the Sisterhood before mobs came to destroy what they did not understand. Dorothea also had allies among the sisters, especially among the new Reverend Mothers. Appalled by the emergency, many of the women had been calling for an end to secrets. 9 of Dorothea's most vehement Reverend Mothers demanded to search the restricted upper caves that held the breeding records, confident they would find proof of illegal technology. Up in the breeding record caves, the isolated chambers held shelves piled with documents printed on incredibly thin sheets of paper. For generations, the women of Rossack had compiled and maintained these mountains of information. It would require an army of Mentats to inspect and analyze it all. Only a subset of the sisters who worked with these hard-copy genetic records knew about the camouflaged holographic wall that concealed a large secondary chamber that contained forbidden computers. But if the Butlerian mobs or Imperial soldiers ransacked the tunnels, demanding answers, someone was sure to stumble upon the wrong room. Rakella knew full well that Dorothea's allies had no concrete proof. Even the new Reverend Mothers had unreliable, non-sequential memories from the past voices they could now access. Her granddaughter might remember some of Rakella's actions from long ago, before the birth of Arlette, but she certainly couldn't be sure what the old Reverend Mother was thinking or doing now. However, merely raising the specter of computers was tantamount to a decree of guilt, and feelings among the sisters were inflamed even further when Rakella flatly refused to grant them access, stationing additional sorceress guards on the high path and accusing Dorothea's allies of gross insubordination. She felt helpless as she watched the sisters take sides. Kerry Marquis and her sister Mentats had already predicted that a dark schism would occur in the Sisterhood. Rakella knew that if she did not openly address the issue, they would see the avoidance as a confession. She had to hold her ground and remain true to the goals she had established, critical goals that would require drastic action. She conferred with Kerry, Valya, Sabra Hublein, and 15 other sisters from her most trusted inner circle, those who knew the deepest secrets. And she gave them their instructions. Then, in a bold move, Rakella summoned every member of the Sisterhood for an emergency meeting at dawn.
As the misty sky brightened with sunrise, more than 1,000 members of the Sisterhood streamed into the largest meeting chamber. In such a huge crowd, no one would notice the absence of Sister Valya and a handful of specially picked assistants. This would be their only chance. Standing before the huge crowd, Reverend Mother Rakella raised her hands and waited for silence to fall. With ancient eyes, she looked out across the sea of faces. Many of you have been eager for an open debate. You have your questions and concerns. It is time for you to speak your minds, all of you. I will listen to you and respond. She nodded to two hand-picked sorceress guards, who closed and locked the doors, sealing all the sisters inside the great chamber. We will stay here until you have spoken your thought, even if it takes the entire day. Rakella was ready for it. But it was all a diversion. She needed to buy time. With the rest of the Sisterhood's members gathered for the huge meeting, Valya and a dozen loyal sisters rushed to dismantle the forbidden computers. Behind the holographic barrier, they broke down the components, removed all the dense gel circuitry storage modules, and used suspensor lifts to drop them down old ventilation and access shafts inside the Cliff City to the bottom of the canyon wall. From there, hushed workers shuttled the sealed components deep into the tangled jungle. Reverend Mother Rakella had shown them a hiding place where the dismantled computers would be protected from the hazards of the dense undergrowth, where they would never be found by Butlerian ransackers, Imperial soldiers, or suspicious sisters. Back when Rakella had nearly died from the Omnius Plague, one of the cast-off Mistborn had taken her out to a hidden home of other deformed exiles in the jungle. In the caverns under a limestone sinkhole, the Mistborn had sheltered her and nursed her back to health. No one else had ever found the place, and the Mistborn had all died out in the decades since. The Reverend Mother had not been there in many years, but she remembered. Valya led her companions into the jungle in a breathless rush, but with military efficiency. The lost cenote would be the perfect hiding place to store the dismantled computers and their priceless genetic information. As Serena Butler's jihad taught us, we must use any conceivable weapon to fight the enemies of humanity. But what if those foes are themselves misguided humans? Ptolemy, Denali Research Journals. When he finished repairing the first of the superlative Simek walkers, Ptolemy felt the return of excitement, even optimism. As he became absorbed in studying the mechanical systems, he almost forgot the pain and disappointment of working alone. Without Dr. Elchan, Ptolemy's work had become an obsession to restore order and fix something that had been broken. And he had to do it for the good of humanity. The thought-trode interfaces connecting the nerves to the armored limbs were extremely complex, and Ptolemy still had much to learn before he would be able to control a mechanical warrior form using neural impulses. On the plus side, the armored bodies were straightforward machines driven by engines, pistons, and cables, and they could be controlled using more traditional means. Ptolemy constructed a small cab slung under one of the crab-like bodies. Sealed and pressurized, with hard-linked inputs to the machine controls, the cab was equipped with life support systems that would allow Ptolemy to ride inside while he explored the murky, caustic landscape of Denali. When he finished testing the systems, Ptolemy climbed through the hatch of the control cab, sealed himself inside, opened the valves on the air tanks, and powered up the systems. The great machine hummed, and the crab-like body raised itself on bulky legs. Even as he imagined being one of the Neo-Simex, he realized that Elchan would have scolded him for such hubris. Ptolemy's whole life had been devoted to progress and the betterment of civilization, never to personal glory. Yet now, he knew that if he succeeded with what he had in mind, great fame and widespread admiration could very well be his. If he survived, and people understood. The veteran researcher moved one of the six legs forward, followed by another, and then another. It was a complicated task to walk in the thing, not at all intuitive, and it amazed him that the Cymex had ever been able to operate their machine bodies so fluidly and in such a wide range of configurations with legs and grappling arms, rolling treads, and even wings. Anxious to practice with the modified machine and to see what he might discover and salvage out on the hostile landscape, Ptolemy sealed off the lab hangar, depressurized it, and used a remote signal to open the bay doors. Greenish fumes roiled into the hangar module. Peering through the plaz windows of his control cab, he set the jointed legs in motion. Delicately at first, and gradually with more confidence, he plodded out onto the boulder-strewn expanse among the Denali research modules. The veil of toxic clouds gave the surroundings a distorted, dreamlike appearance. The light glowing from the research modules was fuzzed by the mist. Adjusting to the rolling, synchronized movement of three pairs of legs, Ptolemy crossed the flat landing field where shuttles dropped off supplies, and then he ventured beyond the vicinity of the research facility. Years ago, while building this secret outpost at an old Cymec base, technicians in environment suits had scouted a kilometer around the facility, but had done little actual exploring farther away. This facility's mission was to conduct important research projects far from the prying eyes of the Butlerians. Few of the scientists were interested in mapping an inhospitable world. Joseph Venport certainly didn't care about the scenery on Denali. Ptolemy, though, was focused on trying to locate any remnants of the old Cymex, technology that he might put to use. As the machine body strode away from the fading lights of the lab domes, he activated his illuminators. Bright eyes stabbed cones of light into the swirling chlorine fumes. At the top of a low rise, he came upon a junkyard of Cymec bodies, large mechanical forms strewn about like carrion on a battlefield. They had dropped in their tracks, like the bones of prehistoric beasts that had come to a special graveyard to die. For him, it was a treasure chest. He halted the clumsy footsteps of the machine legs and stared in awe and delight, imagining all of those warrior forms functioning again, a resurrected army of them. Such a force could stand against any mob of Butlerians. Ptolemy realized he was grinning. If Manfred Tarondo came to destroy the Denali facility, he would find it defended by his greatest nightmares. Even sprawled on the rocks and deactivated, the walker forms looked fearsome. Ptolemy recalled stories about the Titan Ajax, whose machine body had slaughtered entire populations that rebelled against him. Across the screen of his imagination, he envisioned Cymec machines grabbing the superstitious Butlerians, the Swordmasters, anyone intent on mindless destruction. Inside the sealed cab, he worked the controls and clumsily raised the front jointed leg of his walker, lifted a claw-like footpad, and closed it. In his mind, he pictured grasping the torso of a Nari Idaho and crushing her. He imagined that Manfred's savages would throw themselves upon the walker bodies, crawling over them like lice, pummeling and smashing. But it would do the fanatics no good. These Cymec walkers were far too powerful. If he'd only had access to a mechanical body such as this earlier, he could have killed all the Butlerians who raided his research facility on Zenith. And even if he hadn't gotten into the body in time to save the life of Elchan, he might have forced the legless Manfred Tarondo to watch the slaughter of Butlerians, just as the vile man had made Ptolemy witness the horrible death of his closest friend. Now, as he operated the external controls from the enclosed cab, he realized that his limbs and grasping hands were far too clumsy for a swift and fluid battle. He would need to find a direct neural interface so that he and any other defenders of civilization could operate the machines with the proper finesse. He plodded past the Cymec graveyard and went farther along the ridge to where the murky gases cleared. There he found additional collapsing structures, along with 100 more armored walkers. Ptolemy intended to make great use of this windfall. A new defense that would enable rational humans to stand up to the madmen who wanted to plunge civilization into a dark age.
He raised his walker body high, extending the front pair of legs like a man raising his fists and cursing the gods. He who is willing to use an evil tool is himself evil. There are no exceptions. Manfred Tarondo, The Only Path. Showing complete faith in the Mentat's prediction, Manfred guided his warships to the Thanaris star system. He was impressed by, and somewhat afraid of, the way Gilbertus Albans could assemble mountains of facts and tease out patterns based only on subtle hints. Mentat thought processes reminded him of sorcery or sophisticated computer processes, either of which raised equivalent concerns. The headmaster asserted that he was merely demonstrating how the human mind was equivalent to any computer. Though Gilbertus did show an unacceptable underlying admiration for thinking machines, as demonstrated by the disturbing comments he had made to his class, Manfred had come to the conclusion that the Mentats and Butlerians were natural allies, fighting on the same side. Inside his private cabin aboard the lead ballista-class ship, Manfred continued to read horrifying passages from the Erasmus logbooks. The independent robot's cruel descriptions of the tortures and experiments he had inflicted on countless humans, along with his bizarre and repulsive ruminations about the data he collected, only increased Manfred's fear and disgust. People no longer grasped how unspeakably evil the thinking machines were, and Erasmus was by far the worst of them all. Though Manfred had denied him before, the Butlerian leader had decided that Gilbertus Albans was an important ally, and now he showed Gilbertus the replica of the robot's journal. He pointed out some of the most egregious of the revelations. You can see how insidious this is. Every word is proof of what we are fighting against. Erasmus says it himself. Given enough time, they will forget, and they will create us all over again. Gilbertus paled as he examined the dense pages. Using his Mentat abilities, he instantly memorized the words. Reading this frightens me, he admitted. The headmaster was a quiet man preoccupied with running his school and training his students. He still did not seem comfortable about joining this expedition, despite the celebratory mood aboard the ships. Citing a need for meditation to prepare for the upcoming battle, he asked Manfred's permission to be excused and retreated to his quarters. The standard FTL ships had been racing across space for the better part of a week. Since the Thanaris outpost was a long-dead manufacturing center, the Butlerians did not feel enough urgency to risk using the unpredictable space-folding engines. During the journey to the distant system, anticipation and excitement mounted among the Butlerians, like hot moisture filling a steam bath. Manfred had begun to feel, though, that simply bashing another pile of already dead machines was a hollow victory, and it meant far less than his followers thought it did. Still, the more Manfred allowed his zealots to destroy strawman enemies, the more they would be willing to follow him when he called for similar action against less obvious enemies, like machine apologists, who tried to rationalize the use of some thinking machines. His followers were a weapon he could aim and fire. He would let the destruction of the Thanaris shipyards be a pressure release valve and a unifying act. The mind of man is holy. When the ships arrived in the star system, they found the thinking machine base exactly where the Mentat had predicted. But Manfred was astounded to see not a silent and frozen outpost, but a bustling center of industrial activity, manufacturing complexes full of automated assembly lines that fabricated metal hull plates and structural components, spewing heat and exhaust plumes. Huge construction docks hung above broken planetoids where innumerable ships were even now being built. His fellow observers on the bridge let out a collective gasp, Gilbertus Albans among them. 13 armed patrol ships guarded the facilities, and Anari Idaho was the first to spot the sigil of the Venhold spacing fleet on their hulls. Though the Butlerians had almost 20 vessels for every one of the enemies, the Venhold patrol ships lined up to face Manfred's fleet. A pompous voice came across the transmission line. "Attention, intruders!
This facility is owned and operated by Venport Holdings. You are not welcome here.
Disturbed by the man's confident attitude, Manfred responded, "This facility is a haven of illegal thinking machine technology. All these ships, factories, and materiel are forfeit. We intend to destroy them."
He touched his lower lip and added, "You may evacuate your personnel or not, as you wish. It is your choice."
A few moments later, Director Venport himself appeared on the screen.
"How dare you interfere with my legitimate operations? I don't recognize your authority. You are trespassing on Venport property."
In the meantime, Inari Idaho ran through a series of scans. As Manfred and Venport continued to glare at each other across the screens, she said,
"He has reactivated 14 robotic manufacturing facilities. It looks like the machines are working for him."
The Butlerian leader felt sickened.
"Joseph Venport, I don't know whether to consider you appallingly foolish or simply evil."
Venport hardened his expression.
"Turn your barbarians around and depart immediately, or I will file a formal complaint with the Landsrod League and withhold all transportation services to any planet that does not denounce you. I shall also demand legal reparations, every credit, plus punitive damages. More than enough to bankrupt you and put an end to your silly operations."
Inari looked as if she wanted to skewer the comm screen with her sword, but Manfred tried to remain outwardly calm.
"My ships have had their instructions since we departed from Lampadus. File any complaint you like, but we will destroy these facilities today."
He switched off the comm, then issued orders for his front line of armed ships to target the 14 reactivated robotic factories. Gilbertus Albans turned pale.
"Should you not give him time to evacuate personnel?"
"I will not destroy his administration hub or his ships, but those are robotic industrial facilities. Anyone who chooses to reawaken the thinking machine operations is already damned by God."
When the Butlerian fleet launched a volley at the automated machine complexes, the obliteration was quite spectacular. Fuel tanks and compressed gases exploded, flying chunks of debris caromed off other domes and shattered sealed canisters. The comm system lit up once more, and Inari reported,
"Joseph Venport wishes to speak with you again."
"I thought as much."
Manfred gestured to accept the transmission. Venport looked apoplectic.
"You monster! What have you done? I had people over there!"
"I offered you the chance to evacuate. You've already lost. We have more than 200 vessels. Do you intend to return fire with your handful of patrol ships? I will respond to any act of aggression by destroying them as well."
"You are an ignorant man, Tarando," Venport said. "On the contrary, I consider myself intelligent and generous, especially now. Those who chose to work in this facility were led astray, but some of them might yet be saved. As I said before, I will allow you to evacuate personnel. Will 3 ships be sufficient to hold them? You have 1 hour. Gather anyone you wish to save, load them aboard the vessels, and we will receive them as prisoners before we recommence the cleansing of this place. Your own crimes, Director Venport, will be addressed later, after we remove this blight."
"Can a knife cut as deeply as one's conscience?"
Vorian Atreides, Private Journals, Arrakis Period. The freemen stood in a loose circle inside the rock-walled chamber. The fates of the 2 men had already been decided. Naib Sharnak glowered at the pair, but he obviously regarded Griffin Harkonnen as irrelevant and placed most of the blame on Vorian Atreides. And Vor accepted it. He could not burn away the memory of Ishanti's expression as she came to the inevitable conclusion that he could not save her and that he wouldn't give up. She had thrown herself to the worm and refused to let herself be rescued, fearing it would cost all of their lives. Sharnak shook his head.
"I don't know what value Ishanti found in your company, but she was wrong. You have cost a good woman her life.
Standing next to Vor, the young Harkonnen seemed crushed by what he had been through. Griffin had followed a fool's quest, swept along by circumstances that he obviously had not understood or prepared for.
"You should have let me die out there," he mumbled. "I didn't ask to be rescued, especially by you."
Vor could not blame the young man for trying to escape, despite what the attempt had cost.
"That wasn't your decision," he said. "It was mine and Ishanti's. Letting you die out there would have saved us a lot of trouble, and saved that woman's life," the Naib said.
Left alone in the skim craft out in the desert, Vor should have flown away and dropped Griffin at some distant settlement from which he could find his way back to Arrakis City. But the other Freeman aircraft had closed in, and even though Vor could have tried to outfly them, he had come back to the cave encampment. It was a matter of honor.
"My family wanted revenge to wipe the slate clean," Griffin said. "But I'm sorry I ever went after you."
With a pinched expression, the tribal leader looked at the two as if they were annoying children.
"Neither of you should have come here. You don't belong here."
He focused a glare on Vor.
"We did not know you, Vorian Atreides, nor did we wish to know you, and your enemies have caused grave harm to our people. And you, Griffin Harkonnen, have been so fixated on your blood feud that you ignored what you trample over in your pursuit of this man."
Sharnak pulled a long, milky-bladed knife from his waist, then yanked a second dagger from one of the men beside him. He tossed both blades onto the sand-covered floor.
"Have done with this. Settle your feud between yourselves. Now. We do not wish to be a part of it, though we will take your water afterward."
Vor felt a cold hollowness in his chest.
"I don't want to fight him. This quarrel has gone too far already."
The Naib was unyielding.
"Then I will demand your executions right away. Wouldn't the two of you rather attempt to defend yourselves?"
Gray and shaken, Griffin picked up the knife, regarding it as if he'd never seen such a thing. He looked at the blade, at Vor.
"My sister and I have a lifetime of hatred invested in this moment."
Vor did not move for the other knife. He had no heart for this fight. Sharnak looked at Vor with disdain.
"You off-worlders are fools. Do you intend to let him just strike you down as you stand?" "Turn us out into the desert," Vor demanded, "and let us make our own way. We will leave you alone."
He stood stiffly, his arms at his sides. Disgusted and dismissive, the Naib snapped,
"You try my patience. No, I have spoken. Kill them if they don't fight."
The freemen drew knives of their own, edged closer. Vor, though, tried to bargain.
"And the victor, you'll kill him anyway. Maybe, maybe not. Guarantee the life of whoever wins. Promise safe passage to civilization."
Vor narrowed his gray eyes, didn't flinch at the storm of anger that crossed Sharnak's face.
"Or I will just let him strike me down. Better him than desert thieves."
The freemen grumbled, but their leader let out a cold laugh.
"Very well. On my honor, we will deliver the winner to safety, and we'll be glad to be rid of you both."
With great reluctance, Vor bent down for the other dagger and faced Griffin. The young man held up his milky white blade, moving his arm from side to side to test the weight and feel of the weapon. He looked ready, but wary.
"I have my shield belt," Griffin said, "and I see you have yours. Shall we fight like civilized men?"
"Civilized," Vor said.
"You think this is civilized?"
Naib Sharnak scowled.
"Shields? There will be no shields here. Hand to hand, knife to knife."
"I suspected as much," Griffin said.
He drew a deep breath. Then, surprising Vor, he stabbed forward and slashed sideways. The move was a blur of speed, unexpected finesse, and Vor bounded back, barely dodging the razor-sharp blade. Someone had taught this Harkonnen to fight surprisingly well. In response, he jabbed half-heartedly with his dagger, and Griffin's reactions were quick. The young Harkonnen switched the knife to his other hand and struck again. Parrying, Vor felt a glassy clink as edge met edge. These Freeman daggers had no real hilt, no blade guard. As the edges skittered along each other, Vor had to twist his wrist to avoid a deep gash along his knuckles. While the opponents hung poised, dagger against dagger, Vor reached out with his left hand and gave Griffin a hard shove on the chest, making the young man stumble backwards. Then as Griffin caught his balance, Vor cut a quick slash down his left bicep, drawing blood but avoiding an artery. "Do you yield?" Vor didn't want to kill him. The Harkonnen winced, danced backward, and brandished his knife to protect himself. "I can't. In the name of House Harkonnen, I must fight to the death." Vor knew the burden of family honor all too well. This long-standing feud had already soured the Harkonnens against him for generations, and the nuances of honor added other complexities. If he simply surrendered and let the young man win, he doubted if Griffin would feel vindicated or satisfied. And yet, the Freeman would take him to safety. The Freeman threw cheers and insults alike. Vor didn't think they cared which man won. They just wanted to see bloodshed for Ishanti's death. Naib Sharnak regarded the competition in grim silence. Vor drove in, pushing hard. Over the course of his life, he had acquired a great deal of experience in hand-to-hand fighting, but he'd lived at peace and avoided personal combat for decades. He was out of practice. Nevertheless, he closed with the young man, trying to cut him again, but not fatally. Griffin, though, had no such reservations, and he fought with unexpected and precise skill. His technique was unlike anything Vor had fought before, and the doubt behind his adversary's eyes hardened into confidence, as if he heard an encouraging voice in his head. "Did I tell you I went to Kepler?" "Your planet," Griffin said, not even out of breath. "I spoke with your family." Vor felt suddenly cold. He brought up his knife just in time to fend off a strike. "Your wife, Mariella. An old woman." Griffin's words were fast, staccato. "Do you know she is dead?" He chose the instant of shock precisely, and his dagger passed through Vor's defenses and struck his chest just below the right shoulder. By no means a deadly wound, but the pain was sharp. "Mariella." The fight went out of Vor in a cold rush, yet the instinct for survival remained. He pushed back as Griffin leaped on top of him and raised his hand to block another cut. Then Vor kicked out, striking Griffin in the thigh. Both men rolled over. Bleeding from the wound in his shoulder, Vor could barely move his right arm. "What did you do to her?" On the ground with Vor, Griffin struck another blow, an energetic stab that Vor blocked with his blade. But his grip was too weak, and the dagger dropped from his fingers. In a last defense, Vor reached up with his left hand and seized his opponent's wrist to keep the blade poised and away from him. "What did you do to her?" Griffin dug two stiffened fingers into the deep cut in Vor's shoulder. The explosion of pain made Vor dizzy, and a moment later Griffin had the milky white blade pressed against his throat. The young man finally answered with a hint of sorrow in his voice. "I didn't harm her. I arrived on Kepler during her funeral." He pressed the knife closer. "I never wanted to hurt your entire family, as you did to mine. I just wanted you to know that all Harkonnens do not deserve the disgrace you piled on us." Vor did not beg for his life. He lay still, feeling the sharp blade against his neck, waiting for the deep and final cut. His many years, his long connections with Xavier and Abelard Harkonnen, and all the generations afterward, had come to this. He let his words come out in a whisper. "And will taking my life restore your family honor?" Griffin crouched on top of him, his shoulders hunched. The blade trembled against Vor's carotid artery. Tears welled in the young man's eyes, and his expression cycled from anger through uncertainty to dismay. Finally, he lifted the dagger, stood up with a look of disgust, and cast the knife aside. "I choose not to kill you, Atreides, as a matter of honor. You are responsible for what you did to House Harkonnen, but I am responsible for myself." With his left foot, he kicked both knives away and faced the Naib and the muttering Freeman. "The feud is over." "You are weak," Sharnak said.
You crossed the galaxy seeking revenge, and now you are too much of a coward to kill your mortal enemy.
Griffin scowled.
I don't have to explain my choices to you.
Vor struggled to his feet. His bleeding shoulder throbbed, but he blocked the pain. The desert people glared at both of them and moved closer. Sharnak clenched his fist.
Griffin Harkonnen, you stole water from the tribe, and that crime warrants your death. Vorian Atreides, you are his accomplice. The blood feud may be over between you, but the water debt to my people must be paid. We will take your body's water, and may the universe forget about you both.
Wait!
Vor fumbled inside the pockets of his tight desert suit, using his left hand. Blood had soaked his outfit, but the fabric's water absorption capability would reclaim it, if he lived that long. His fingers found the packet he sought, and he yanked it out. He tossed the small pouch onto the floor where the sand still showed arcane patterns of their scuffle.
You value water over people. I believe I'll mourn Ishanti more than you do.
The Naib looked at the pouch as if it were filled with scorpions.
What is this? If our crime is stealing water, I repay you with water chits from working on the spice crew. Everything I earned. Redeem them in Arrakis City for 5 times the water that Griffin stole.
The free men looked down at the packet. Many in the tribe were outcasts who had never left the great sandy basins, but others had gone into the city. They knew how to spend the credits. The Naib seemed uncertain about the offer. Vor pressed,
Would you kill us anyway and just take my credits? Do your people have honor, or are you just thieves after all?
The freemen were not satisfied.
He owes us more than water, one warrior pointed out. Take their water, another said.
But the Naib drew himself up.
We are not thieves or murderers. No number of water chits can repay us for the suffering you have brought, but Ishanti found some value in your lives. I will not have her spirit angry with us, so I do this for her. Not you.
His brows drew together, then he bent to snatch the water tokens from the floor.
But you must leave the CH and go far away.
Sharnak looked around at the desert men, waiting for them to challenge his decision. But he was their Naib. They respected his words, and no one spoke against him.
So be it, the tribal leader said. One of my people will take you in Ishanti's skimcraft. We know of a weather monitoring station many kilometers from here. There we will leave you alone. Use the communication in that place to send a message, but do not ever return here.
In a formal, cold demonstration of his censure, Naib Sharnak turned his back and refused to look again at Vorian or Griffin, an act eerily similar to how Vor had turned his back on Abelard Harkonnen after his conviction for cowardice.
We want nothing more to do with either of you. Computers are seductive and will employ all of their wiles to bring us down.
Manford Torondo, The Only Path. For Rakella, this was the stuff of nightmares. She, Valya, and a dozen sorceress watchers stood on the high cliff, gazing at a sky filled with gold-hulled imperial warships that dropped like locusts from a giant space folder in orbit. It was mid-afternoon, and beyond the assault force the sky was clear and blue, deceptively tranquil, with the distant volcanoes slumbering. As soon as she recognized the Carino Lion insignia, she realized this was not an undisciplined attack from a hodgepodge of fanatics, but that did not diminish her concern. Previously, she might have assumed an official imperial response would be more reasoned, more disciplined, but after the tragedy of Anna, the Emperor had every reason to be wrathful. Rakella knew that her own life, and the very existence of the Sisterhood, was on the line. At least, he did not bring the Butlerians with him, she said, glancing at Valya, who stood pale and tense beside her. Ship after ship settled onto the sweeping silvery-purple canopy that had been designated as a landing area. Perhaps that is one small glimmer of hope.
In the cave city beneath the high viewpoint, she watched sisters scurrying about in confusion. She heard their agitated voices, their cries of alarm. Even the members of Dorothea's faction had good reason to be worried. They realized they might have unleashed a dragon. For all their training and focus on mental abilities, for all their meditation and muscle control, the sisters were not an army. Even the handful of sorceress descendants could do little to fight battles with their psychic powers. Emperor Salvador Carino, on the other hand, had brought a fully armed military force. Resistance would only serve to antagonize him and rain down destruction upon the sisterhood. No, they must not fight, Rakela decided. She would accept the blame and die for what had happened to Anna Carino, if that preserved the sisterhood. Thanks to the good work of Sister Valya, none of the Imperial searchers would find evidence of the illegal computers. Any other accusations Dorothea had made would fall flat. As uniformed Imperial soldiers disembarked from the military transport craft on the treetops, the Reverend Mother was struck by how very youthful the men were, even the officers who followed them. The air was a hum of machinery, terrible efficiency, and impending violence. Smaller suspensor gunships dropped down along the sheer cliffside, hovering in place with weapons directed toward the cave openings. A bombardment would bring down the rocks on the trails, seal the tunnels, and kill all the sisters. But thus far, no shots had been fired. Cary Marquis gathered a dozen intimidating-looking sorceresses around Rakela. Long ago, their legendary psychic powers had inspired awe and fear, but that was little more than a faded memory now. "We will help defend the sisterhood, Reverend Mother," Cary said. "The Emperor would never attempt such a bold invasion if we had more sorceresses." "There's nothing you can do, Cary. They will kill us all if we try to do battle." She began to walk down to meet the troops. "We must find some way to satisfy them." A large, ornate suspensor ship drifted down to the already crowded landing area, and Rakela could see military officers hurrying about their duties. On the polymerized treetops, soldiers rushed to form a cordon, preparing for the arrival of the Imperial flagship. A ramp with handrails shot from the side of the vessel, and specially uniformed soldiers streamed across the ramp, their weapons glowing from the ready charges. Elite troops. The Emperor's personal guard. Two older officers followed, and then Emperor Salvador Carino himself emerged with his brother Roderick and an imperious-looking Sister Dorothea two steps behind. Valya made her disgust clear. "As I thought, Dorothea betrayed us." "She did something, that's for certain. I'm going to speak with them directly." Valya drew courage from within herself, straightened her back. "If the Emperor is here to demand revenge for what happened to Anna, I should accompany you." "I am Reverend Mother. The responsibility is mine." Rakela's smile had little reassurance. "But yes, I do want you to come along. Maybe we can salvage this situation. Show them what they want to see." She turned to the aged sorceress. "Cary, gather the sister Mentats and have them wait for us in the caves with the breeding records. We will allow the Emperor to search anywhere he likes, and hope we can convince him that the sisterhood uses only human computers." Cary Marquis hurried off as Rakela and Valya descended the path. In front of the Imperial flagship, attendants busied themselves setting up a small pavilion and a sturdy chair for the Emperor, out where he could observe the operations. Salvador wore full military dress complete with a Chandler sidearm. A lavish display of medals, ribbons, and golden lion designs across the chest made his red jacket look more like a costume than a real commander's uniform. As he saw the Reverend Mother approach, his voice boomed out, amplified across speaker systems on the landed ships. "Planet Rossak is currently under lockdown, pending an investigation into allegations of egregious crimes against humanity." Her head held high, Rakela walked on the paved expanse of treetops where the ships had landed. Her entourage followed closely, but she did not look back at them. "Your military might is impressive, sire, and these sisters acknowledge your authority." She strode closer, showing no fear, and Salvador scrambled to situate himself on his temporary throne. Roderick and Dorothea took positions on either side of him. I represent this school, Rakela continued, and I speak for these women. I dispatched our Reverend Mother Dorothea to return your sister Anna, along with my sincerest apologies for the harm she suffered. She gestured to the military troops who stood at attention around the Emperor. Obviously, that was insufficient. How else do you require me to atone for that terrible accident? Salvador fidgeted on his throne. That isn't why we've come at all. He looked to Roderick in irritation, then lifted his chin and cleared his throat. In addition to the tragedy that befell our dear sister, we have received reports that your school uses outlawed thinking machines to manage your extensive breeding records. He sniffed a whistling breath through his narrow nose. I am also aware that you have made projections about which families should be allowed to reproduce, even the Carino line, and me in particular. Now Rakela felt ice water wash through her veins. She had not expected this. As a reverend mother, Dorothea had access to other memories, and through them she could have learned about the computers. But she could not possibly have known about the projected flaw in Salvador's genetics. Only Dr. Joma could have made that particular revelation. Either the soup doctor had betrayed Rakela outright, or she'd been caught and tortured. The whisper of other memory voices suddenly grew so loud and alarmed that Rakela could barely think. Salvador lowered his voice to a growl so that only Rakela and the nearby sisters could hear. Your breeding records are fatally flawed if they say that your emperor cannot be allowed to produce an heir. His nostrils flared. He seemed embarrassed to add this charge to the list of the sisterhood's crimes, not wanting to call attention to the idea that his own genetics might be faulty. Rakela chose to be audacious. Sister Dorothea says these things. She shook her head, feigning sadness. It is to be expected. She only recently took poison, a near-fatal ordeal as part of the transformation to become a reverend mother. Delusions and psychological damage often result from such a massive dose of mind-altering drugs. You saw the unfortunate side effects that your dear sister Anna suffered as a result of a similar overdose. She saw the rising anger plain on Dorothea's face, but continued to gaze dispassionately at the Emperor. Did my granddaughter also reveal to you that she herself lay in a coma for days before emerging, alive but changed? Granddaughter? The Emperor flashed an accusatory look at Dorothea, then back at Rakela. Are you saying this could all have been an hallucination? If this woman was unstable, why did you send her to the Imperial Court? Rakela continued. The desperate situation with Anna required an immediate response, and we chose Dorothea, my own granddaughter, as our representative because of her past service to the Imperial Throne. I believed she had recovered, but now I fear she has begun to suffer delusions. Dorothea's voice had a sharp edge. The Reverend Mother can cast doubts all she likes, sire, but the Sisterhood has a chamber filled with computers. That is all the proof we need. In all ways, humans are superior to machines, Rakela said, almost in intonation. Don't quote the Orange Catholic Bible to me, Salvador snapped. I just released a new edition in my own name. She answered more carefully. During the jihad, I worked with Mohandas Souk to aid the victims of machine plagues, so I've seen firsthand the evils of thinking machines. I watched entire populations die because of them, so I would never try to recreate them here. Roderick Carino stepped forward when it was obvious the Emperor didn't know what to say. We have enough concerns to warrant a search of Rossek, and a purge if necessary. There are computers here, Dorothea insisted. And where exactly are these computers, granddaughter? Rakela's gentle questioning made it clear that she pitied the other woman. Have you seen them, other than in a dream? I've seen them, in my other memories. The voices told me about them. Your memories told me. With a knowing nod, Rakela spoke to the Emperor. I see. She has voices in her head. It was all she needed to say. Show me where you keep these breeding records, in whatever form, Salvador demanded, rising from his throne. I want to see the ones that refer to my family line and my offspring. With a smile, Rakela said, Let me take you to our archives in the restricted caves. Everything was prepared. Breeding charts and labyrinthine family trees were kept in inefficient but durable handwritten form. The files were by no means complete, but would be handed over to the Emperor. Sister Mentats had assembled the appropriate volumes. As she led the way up the trail, Rakela's mind raced. What did he know? Had he interrogated Dr. Joma? Had the soup doctor already managed to slip a chemical sterilization drug into his food, or had she failed entirely? As you well know, sire, compiling a vast database of genetic information has been a vital project for centuries on Rossak. We do have information on the Butlers and the Carinos, as well as all important families. The sorceresses and my sisters have never made any secret of this. While the extensive military presence remained in position, she led the Emperor and his entourage up the restricted cliff path to the upper caves. Once inside, Rakela showed them the former computer chamber, which now contained only tables, desks, and bookcases filled with bound copies of breeding records. Seven black-robed Sister Mentats sat at the tables absorbing the information, overseen by the sorceress Mentat, Kerry Marquis. Kerry removed one of the volumes from a shelf and displayed it for Emperor Salvador. Sire, we have eight Sister Mentats, whose full-time assignment is to commit centuries of information to memory, adding to what we already know. Once we have sufficient data, we can begin to perform analyses and projections. These women are human computers, trained on Lampidus in a school supported by the Butlerians. In fury, Dorothea ran to the shelved volumes, opened several of them, and tossed them on the floor. Her voice became shrill. The thinking machines were here. Computer databases filled with centuries of information, making bloodline projections down the generations. Roderick and the Emperor looked at other volumes, as did some of the unimpressed military officers. Red-faced, Salvador glared at Dorothea, who looked desperate. Pulling away from the group, she ran from chamber to chamber, searching, but found nothing. Finally, she stood in a doorway with a confused and angry expression on her face. Sire, they must have hidden the computers somewhere. Rakela said in her most reasonable tone, You are welcome to search the entire Cliff City, sire. The Sisterhood's only thinking machines are our human computers. With Mentats, we need no forbidden technology. Valya spoke up, sounding nervous, but Rakela knew the quaver in her voice was a careful act. Excuse me, Your Highness, but it is possible that Sister Dorothea is guilt-ridden over what happened to poor Anna. She works in the Sisterhood's pharmaceutical research laboratories, and she is the one who formulated the poison dose that your sister consumed. Dorothea's eyes widened as she heard this. The capsule was formulated for you, Valya, not for Anna Carino. You're mistaken. I still have the capsule you gave me. As proof, she withdrew a small dark pill from a pocket in her robe. Old Kerry Marquis gave Dorothea a damning look, then faced the Emperor. Sister Valya is correct, sire. Dorothea assists me in the pharmaceutical laboratory. The drugs are meant to be administered under only the most carefully controlled circumstances, but she mistakenly allowed a very dangerous dose to leave the labs unmonitored. Against all warnings, your poor sister took the poison. Dorothea sputtered in protest, but Salvador was clearly growing angry and impatient with all of them. We've heard enough from you for today. I see this investigation will have to go much further than I expected. Even though Rakela had made Dorothea look foolish, she did not feel safe. The Emperor had no proof, but he had suspicions. Maintaining her composure, she looked him in the eye and said, "I swear you will have our full cooperation, sire."
A worthy opponent is more satisfying than any financial reward. Gilbertus Albans, Tactical Manual, Mentat School of Lampetus. The explosions that ripped apart the Thanaris automated factories removed any doubt from Joseph Fenport's mind. Even he had not expected the barbarians to be so bloodthirsty. Ignorant, yes, but not so vicious.
"Damn you and your stupid fear of what you don't understand," he whispered. It was all Joseph could do to hold his shouts within. He wished Sioba could be there with him, but at the same time felt relief that she was safe on Kolhar. Not long ago, when the scientist Ptolemy had come to Kolhar describing the half-Manford's murderous attack on his lab, Joseph assumed he had exaggerated the extent of the violence. Now he saw for himself that the Butlerians were rampaging mad dogs. They had not targeted the administration hub yet, but Joseph did not expect any sympathy from the legless wonder. He turned to the Mentat beside him. "He killed hundreds of my people who were operating the machines. Destroyed those facilities. He won't stop. You know that." Observing the destruction, Drago Roger's eyes flicked back and forth as thoughts whirled through his mind. "That precipitous act was designed to force you to surrender. Their military force is far superior to our own. Give me an alternative, Mentat. I vow to you that I will not surrender these shipyards without a fight. Use your tactical knowledge. Use anything we have available, and find me a way to defeat Manford Tarondo."
"That will be difficult, sir. We will be lucky to leave here with our lives."
Joseph breathed in, exhaled, and stared intently out at the Thanaris complex and the looming barbarian fleet. "Then at least find me a way to hurt him."
Gilbertus had already memorized the positions of the various planetoids, the main facilities, the 13 armed Venhold patrol ships, the group of vessels under construction. Using techniques that Erasmus had taught him a long time ago, he assembled a mental three-dimensional blueprint of the whole complex and then poked at it, trying to find flaws, imagining any way that a desperate, possibly suicidal opponent could use those game pieces to defend against the overwhelming Butlerian force. He didn't expect Joseph Venport to accept defeat easily. At the Mentat School, Gilbertus had played many tactical games like this with his best student Drago, thought experiments and practice sessions that were much like the games he and Erasmus had played on Corin. Now that Manford Tarondo had forced him to accompany the Butlerian fleet, the exercise seemed much more real to him. The first-hand experience gave him data that he had not previously possessed. Destroying these automated factories was not the same as accruing points in an academic, tallied score. Though he could never say such things aloud, especially in the presence of the Butlerians, he remembered with fondness the cool efficiency of robotic factories, the predictability of a steady output. As far as Gilbertus was concerned, his time with Erasmus had been calm and comforting, far different from the wild whipsaw of emotions displayed by the volatile Butlerians. Real human workers had just died in those explosions. It was all very unsettling.